You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. It's brought to you by the barristers at 1 Crown Office Row, and this edition is presented by Emma-Louise Fenlon.
For our listeners practising in medical law, they are probably familiar with the Quarterly Medical Law Review, a publication produced by 1 Crown Office Row, which covers the latest developments in clinical negligence, personal injury, inquests, inquiries, court of protection, costs, civil procedure rules, abuse and judicial review. What they might not know is that the QMLR now has a website which has an archive that is fully searchable and accessible, which makes it terrifically useful as a resource for keeping abreast of recent developments. Here with me is the review's editor-in-chief, Raj Kiran Barhe, and Richard Mumford, both of 1 Crown Office Row. And today, we're going to tell you about five key developments, all available on the QMLR website, which are likely to be of interest to medical law practitioners. Richard, starting with you, you're going to tell us about medical claims under Section 75 of the Consumer Credit Act 1974. Can you tell us what this is all about?
So, Emma, what this is about is if you pay for something on a credit card and you don't get what you bargained for, then you may be able to bring a claim not just against the supplier, but against your credit card company for any misrepresentation or breach of contract committed by the supplier.
And how does that work?
So this all comes from, as you mentioned, the Consumer Credit Act 1974 and Section 75 of that Act. And that provides that if you pay for something under a debtor-creditor-supplier agreement, and the most common example of that is a credit card agreement, and you have a claim against the supplier for either misrepresentation or breach of contract, then you will have, in quotes, a like claim against the credit card company, which will be jointly and severally liable along with the supplier. And this applies to all sorts of transactions. In the reported cases, you have everything from buying a conservatory through to treatment for baldness. But it's been mentioned in the news recently regarding the PIP litigation, the breast implant litigation, where some of the claimants in that group action were able, as long ago as 2013, to rely on the section to secure compensation in an out-of-court settlement against their credit card provider, Lloyds TSB. And that meant they avoided the arduous process of pursuing the manufacturers of the implants through the French courts.
And can you tell us why this is likely to be of interest to those practising in clinical negligence?
Well, most people will be aware of the media coverage recently about the pressures on the NHS as a result of COVID-19 and the effect on waiting lists. And statistics from NHS England published in April showed that as at February this year, 4.7 million people were waiting to begin treatment. And that's the highest number since records began in 2007. There's also been a lot of headlines recently about NHS dental waiting lists of up to 3 years. But even before COVID struck, in the 5 years before 2019, there was a significant increase in spending on self-funded private healthcare. That's to say, private healthcare that is not being paid for by an insurer. A report by an organisation called Langbusson in November 2019 noted a doubling in the self-funded private healthcare market. It was said to be present across all specialities, but particularly orthopaedics, ophthalmology, gastroenterology, gynaecology and urology, and a particular growth in demand for diagnostic services such as MRI scans, CT scans and endoscopy. Alongside all that, the cosmetic surgery sector, which obviously has been dampened during COVID, is likely to see a resurgence as restrictions are lifted and confidence increases. And the upshot of all this is that there is more private healthcare going on, more of it is being self-funded, and I would say it's reasonable to assume more of it is being paid for on credit cards and hence a greater potential volume of claims against credit card companies when that treatment does not turn out as hoped.
And so in what situations might this cause of action be useful?
Yeah, well, essentially there's three particular situations which I think practitioners should have in mind. I mean, the first is that you have a guaranteed traceable defendant. It's not always easy to track down individual practitioners, particularly after time has passed since the treatment in question. People die or they move abroad. Even when they can be tracked down, it's not always straightforward to deal with an individual practitioner. There may be a refusal to notify insurers or the medical defence organisation and so on. And that relates to the second point. Here we have the advantage of a guaranteed solvent defendant, assuming that the credit card company is still operating. Regrettably, insurance is not always in place or necessarily adequate to meet what can be very significant claims in the medical context. And the third point to bear in mind as well about the advantages of having a credit card company as the defendant, this can apply to treatment which has been received abroad but paid for on a UK credit card. So it avoids having to sue the defendant supplier in his or her own court. So, for example, if you have dental treatment in Budapest or cosmetic surgery in Thailand, but you've paid for that on a UK credit card, you can bring your claim against the UK credit card company. And that's going to be a lot more straightforward to pursue a defendant domiciled in the jurisdiction of England and Wales. So those are the three areas I think practitioners should particularly have in mind when thinking about this.
And what do claimants need to show in order to succeed in such claims?
Well, the first thing is that the treatment has to be paid for under a relevant debtor-creditor-supplier agreement. Section 75 doesn't apply to debit card purchases. The second thing that a claimant will have to show is that the debtor under the credit agreement and the individual who has contracted with the supplier are one and the same. So in the clinical context, the paradigm example of this is going to be the patient who has used his or her own credit card to purchase treatment. But there may be some areas of flexibility around this. The third thing to look at in terms of threshold requirements for bringing a claim is that there was a misrepresentation or a breach of contract by the supplier, because what one is bringing against the credit card company is a claim which is a like claim to that against the supplier. So in brief, a misrepresentation is essentially a misleading statement that has caused an individual to enter into a contract. Thinking about this in the clinical context, this might be a statement by the supplier that a treatment will definitely work if in fact the chances of success were significantly less than 100%. As far as a breach of contract is concerned, again, in the clinical context, one is generally looking at a breach of an implied term to exercise reasonable care and skill. That's a term which is implied at common law, but also under Section 49 of the Consumer Rights Act 2015. And Section 50 of the same Act goes even further by providing that anything that is said or written to the consumer by the trader, about the trader or about the service, so quite a wide range of statements may be effectively given contractual status. So those are the threshold requirements, really, that one is looking at in this context.
It occurs to me that these sorts of additional causes of action could apply to an enormous number of cases. Are there any limits or constriction on the sorts of cases that can apply?
Well, there is a financial limit that does narrow the scope slightly, in that the cash price of the goods or services in question must be more than £100 and not more than £30,000. A claim relating to services valued at more than £30,000 may be possible under Section 75A of the Act, but that has slightly different provisions about whether the supplier has to be pursued first. What is worth bearing in mind, though, in this context, is that not all of the cost of the treatment has to be paid for on credit card. as long as you have paid for some of it on a credit card, even a deposit of less than £100, Section 75 is triggered.
Yeah, and you mentioned whether or not one needs to sue the supplier in certain circumstances. Generally, do claimants need to sue the supplier?
No, they don't. Under Section 75, there's no requirement to pursue the supplier first or at all. In fact, the Financial Services Ombudsman has ordered a credit card company to pay compensation to a customer for repeatedly and incorrectly telling him that it was only required to meet his claim if he first obtained a court judgment against the supplier. However, the prudent course for practitioners is likely to be to pursue both the credit card company and the supplier in the same action if there is any concern about the supplier's solvency or cooperation in the proceedings.
I wonder if, given what you've described, there's a risk for barristers involved in advising in these claims of a professional negligence case being brought against them in the event that they don't advise clients to pursue this cause of action where treatment has been paid for by credit card. Has that arisen in the courts before?
Yes. There's a case called Bond and Livingston and Co., which was reported back in 2001. And that was actually an application for summary judgment by Mr. Bond against his solicitors in professional negligence for failing to advise him correctly about his prospects of succeeding on a claim against his credit card companies. Now, the context of that case was a species of clinical negligence claim where Mr. Bond had sought treatment for baldness from a private clinic. His solicitors pursued the claim against the clinic, but failed to realise that they could also proceed against his credit card companies. By the time they realised that they could, it was too late, and his claim was struck out against the credit card companies for limitation reasons. And so he pursued his solicitors in a professional negligence action and was successful. And the judgment in that case contained some fairly scathing criticisms of his advisers for failing to realise that they had this opportunity to bring a claim under Section 75, which would have secured compensation for Mr. Bond. So it is a real issue, I think, for practitioners to be aware of. It may be that not many cases involving credit card treatment come across your desk, but when they do, these are points that I think people should be alive to.
Absolutely. Well, we will include a link to that case and to your QMLR article on this. Next, we're going to talk about non-delegable duties. Kieran, perhaps you could start us off by telling us what are non-delegable duties.
So some of you may be familiar with the term non-delegable duties of care, but it's commonly used to refer to duties, not merely to take personal care in performing a given function, but to ensure that care is taken. So the expression refers to a higher standard of care than the ordinary duty of care. And duties involving this higher standard of care are described as non-delegable because they cannot be discharged merely by the exercise of reasonable care in the selection of a third party to whom the function in question is delegated. So that's what the case that I'm going to discuss is really all about, this special type of duty.
And this is the relatively recent case of Hopkins and Akrami, Badger Group and the NHS Commissioning Board. So can you tell us a little bit about the facts of that case?
Yes, the claimant was a two-year-old child, fell unwell, and their grandmother rang the GP surgery. The other end of the phone, there was an automated message, which gave her a telephone number for an out-of-hours service. She rang the out-of-hours service and was advised to go to the Badger Medical Centre at the Selly Oak Hospital. The Badger Medical Centre was run by the second defendant, Badger Group, a private company who provided out-of-hours services to NHS patients at the centre, pursuant to a contract with the third defendant, the South Birmingham Primary Care Trust. However, the claimant's grandmother was not aware that the Badger Medical Centre was run by a private hospital. As far as she was aware, it was an NHS clinic which was part of the hospital. The claimant attended the Badger Medical Centre, was examined by a nurse, who was the first defendant, who diagnosed the claimant with acute pharyngitis, gave her advice, and sent her home. The nurse was engaged by the second defendant, Badger Group, to provide nurse practitioner services at their clinic. The claimant didn't improve and was rushed to hospital the next day, and was sadly subsequently diagnosed with serious neurological damage. It was noted by the judge that the first defendant, the nurse, was insured, but her insurance was unlikely to be sufficient to satisfy any claim that the claimant might have. The second defendant was uninsured for the purposes of liability to the claimant, and the extent of the second defendant's assets were unknown. And so I think partly in response to that, the third defendant, the NHS Commissioning Board, was added as a party. And just to explain, the NHS Commissioning Board succeeded to the liabilities of Primary Care Trust pursuant to legislation. So on that fairly complicated background, this was a trial on the preliminary issue. And the only issue was whether the third defendant, as successors to the relevant liabilities of the Primary Care Trust, owed a non-delegable duty of care to the claimant, so as to render it liable in respect of any negligent acts or omissions of those providing medical care at the Badger Medical Centre, and in particular, the first defendant.
And so, as you say, it is rather complicated, but in a nutshell, what did the court hold?
So in a nutshell, Her Honour Judge Clark found that the Primary Care Trust didn't have a non-delegable duty. Now, she noted that a non-delegable duty of care can arise under statute or it can arise under common law. And whether or not it arises under statute is a matter of statutory interpretation. And so some listeners may be thinking, non-delegable duties, that must be the Woodland case and the criteria set out by Lord Sumption in that case. But what was stated in this case is that that case was relevant to whether a non-delegable duty will arise in common law. But in the present case, what was primarily relevant was the statutory context. And that was central to the decision in this case. So in that context, the judge went on to consider the key decision, which was the Supreme Court's 2017 judgment in Arms and Nottinghamshire County Council. That case concerned children who were abused by their foster parents, and the issue was whether the local authority owed the children a non-delegable duty. The court found that the local authority didn't owe a non-delegable duty to ensure that the children in its care who had been placed with foster carers were treated with reasonable care. And in that case, Lord Reed made a really significant distinction, which is relevant in Hopkins, and that was a distinction between a duty to perform and a duty to arrange. And he said that the critical question was whether the local authority were under a duty to perform the function of providing the child with day-to-day care, or whether the local authority simply had a duty to arrange to have the child cared for.
And so how did that distinction play out in Hopkins?
So Her Honour Judge Clark found that in Hopkins there was only a duty to arrange, and the basis of that decision was the statute. So she looked at Section 83(1) of the NHS Act 2006, which was the relevant statute, and what it said was each primary care trust must, to the extent that it considers necessary to meet all reasonable requirements, exercise its powers so as to provide primary medical services within its area or secure their provision within its area. So what she found was that, as per this provision, the Primary Care Trust could discharge its duty in two different ways. And so it either could discharge its duty by providing medical services, which she described as being like the duty to perform, or it could secure the provision of medical services, which was the duty to arrange. And she found that by contracting with a third party, the PCT had chosen to discharge its duty by arranging the provision of services. So it hadn't delegated the very duty which it itself had to fulfil, which is the case in a sort of typical non-delegable duty type case. And she also stated that the PCT had a duty to exercise reasonable care in selecting the contractor, but it retained no responsibility to ensure that those providing that care did so safely. So even though the ultimate outcome seems surprising to people, in that, as I said, the grandmother of the claimant had no knowledge at any point that she was dealing with anything other than NHS services. And for example, had she taken the claimant to A&E instead, there would have been no dispute that they would have been able to bring a claim against the NHS. And ultimately, that was the outcome in this case.
It's definitely a case that practitioners will want to consider when pleading and responding to pleadings that assert a non-delegable duty. Next, we're going to talk about secondary victim claims. Gideon Barth of One Crown Office Row previously covered this subject on the podcast about a year ago. But Richard, you're going to tell us about an important recent development in this area.
Yes, this was a very sad case about the death of a young girl named Esme Palmier from undiagnosed pulmonary veno-occlusive disease. And it's also about the psychiatric injury to her parents caused by witnessing her final moments. So in 2014, age six, Esme had experienced episodes of not catching her breath, appearing pale or blue, each episode lasting around 30 minutes and occurring initially every other week, but with increasing frequency. She was referred by her GP to the Defendant's Hospital and seen on the 1st of December 2014. An ECG did not reveal any abnormality, but Esme continued to suffer episodes. The GP made a further referral to the Defendant's Hospital in April 2015, noting the parents' concern. On the 1st of July 2015, before Esme had been seen again at the hospital, she became unwell at school, eventually collapsing. Her parents were called to attend and witnessed paramedics attempting resuscitation. Sadly, that was unsuccessful and Esme died. Esme's parents brought a claim as secondary victims of the defendant's negligent failure to diagnose and treat Esme's condition. The parents claimed psychiatric injury had been caused by witnessing the horrifying event of Esme's unsuccessful resuscitation. The Defendant Hospital admitted that there was a negligent failure to diagnose the true cause of Esme's episodes by January 2015. Nonetheless, the defendant applied to strike out the parents' claims on the grounds that the Olcott control mechanism of proximity was not satisfied because of the gap in time between the defendant's negligence and Esme's actual death, particularly where Esme had, during that gap, continued to experience episodes which would have constituted injury for which a claim could, in theory, have been brought. The defendant relied on the Court of Appeals decision in a case called Taylor and Novo. That was a case in which the primary victim suffered an accident at work, which was a collapse of racking boards which injured her head and her left foot. 20 days later, she died suddenly and unexpectedly at home as a result of DVT and pulmonary embolism, which had been the result of her injuries sustained in the accident. A claim by her daughter, who witnessed her mother's death, but not her accident at work, was disallowed because the daughter did not satisfy the criterion of proximity in space and time to the original accident at work.
And so in the strikeout application itself, how did the defendant get on?
Well, the defendant's application to strike out the claims was rejected. Master Cook held that the proximity control mechanism, as interpreted most recently by Mr. Justice Chamberlain in a case called Paul and the Royal Wolverhampton NHS Trust, that control mechanism did not prevent recovery just because the primary victim, in this case Esme, had suffered actionable injury between the date of negligence and the date of the horrifying event, her collapse and death, which had given rise to the secondary victim's psychiatric injury. Master Cook noted that permission had been granted for the defendant's appeal in the case of Paul and Wolverhampton that I've mentioned already, and that was going to be heard by the Court of Appeal. And so Master Cook granted the defendant in Palmier permission to appeal and ordered that the appeal be transferred to the Court of Appeal. It wasn't within his gift to order that the appeal be heard at the same time as the appeal in Paul, but that would appear to have been his intention.
I'm sure any listeners involved in advising on claims like this will be well aware that it's become increasingly difficult to give accurate advice on prospects when it comes to these strikeout applications in secondary victim claims. What does this case mean for practitioners advising their clients?
Well, I think, in truth, we're still in a state of uncertainty. As Master Cook himself notes in his judgment, there have been an increasing number of secondary victim claims made in the context of clinical negligence cases. And in many of those claims, applications to strike out are made by the defendant, relying on the Court of Appeals decision in Taylor and Novo. And there is considerable uncertainty as to the application of the Alcott criteria to clinical negligence cases. A failure to diagnose an illness which many months or even years later leads to a sudden death witnessed by secondary victims does not fit well within the paradigm of an accident external to the primary victim, such as the collapse of racking boards that occurred in the Taylor and Novo case. This may be a case that goes along with Paul to the Supreme Court. That is far from impossible, so there may be continued uncertainty. However, it is to be hoped that at least when the Court of Appeal hears this appeal and the appeal in Paul, there will be a clarification as to the state of the law in relation to secondary victims in clinical negligence cases.
Next, we're going to look at some procedural updates, and Kieran is going to answer the age-old question of when is a claim too stale, and in particular talk about ASAM and University Hospital Birmingham NHS Foundation Trust, a recent case looking at limitation. Kieran, can you tell us what was the case about?
In this case, the claimant alleged that surgery performed to correct gynecomastia, a condition in which men develop breast tissue, was carried out negligently. The surgery was performed in March 1996. The claim was issued in July 2017, so over 21 years after the procedure, and the operating surgeon had in fact died in April 2014. So unsurprisingly, the defendant raised the defence of limitation, and that's what the judgment is all about.
And so in terms of what's said about limitation, and practitioners will of course be aware of the discretion that the court has in Section 33 of the Limitation Act, but in terms of what the court held, how does this clarify the issue of cases that are brought a very long time after the original negligence?
So I think it's a really useful decision in terms of how to approach these cases. So at trial on the preliminary issue of limitation, the judge held that primary limitation expired in March 1999, as the claimant had the requisite knowledge more or less immediately after his operation. But he agreed to extend the limitation period using the Section 33 discretion. And he rejected the trust's argument that it would suffer significant real prejudice in terms of its ability to defend the claim. Now, unsurprisingly, perhaps, the trust appealed. However, Mr. Justice Saini upheld the decision by the first instance judge. He noted that the trust had failed to provide any evidence that, given the passage of time, the trust's evidence was likely to be less cogent. And that was really the key plank of the trust's submissions. He noted that the only evidence provided by the trust was the death of the operating surgeon. But he commented that the trust didn't provide any evidence as to steps that it had taken to find other witnesses or whether those witnesses had any recollection of the events. And it had not provided any other evidence to support its assertion that its evidence was likely to be less cogent. And he also noted that the medical records from the procedure were full and were available. Furthermore, he noted that the trust had provided no evidence to show how the operating surgeon's death would impact on the expert evidence. So the trust asserted that any expert that they instructed wouldn't really be able to give a view because of the passage of time and the lack of evidence from the operating surgeon. However, Mr. Justice Saini commented that the trust had not instructed an expert that could evidence that claim. And so I think the lesson from this case is that if pursuing a limitation argument in this way, it's important to make sure you have the evidence to back up the assertion, in this case, for example, that the passage of time was likely to lead to significant prejudice. And so it's not sufficient to point to the fact of the passage of time. You need to evidence the fact that the passage of time will have made a difference. And so I think it's a really helpful decision in that way.
Do you think defendants will be particularly concerned about this decision?
I think they may be on its face, but I think what the judgment emphasises is that if you get the evidence to back up the assertions that are made, then you have a much better chance of succeeding. And I think that was the real issue in this case, was that they simply hadn't got the evidence to support their assertion that the death of the surgeon would make a difference to their ability to defend the claim. But I think there is evidence that could be obtained to support that. And so I think there are certainly ways of for defendants to build a sufficient case.
Richard, finally, one for you. This case, T and Imperial College Healthcare NHS Trust, is a case looking at a very late request for a joint single expert. Can you tell us a little bit about the facts of that case?
Yes. So this was a case brought by T, who's anonymised in the judgment. T was bringing a claim for injury alleged to have been sustained at the time of his birth, and that injury was in the form of chronic partial hypoxic ischemia leading to cerebral palsy. The defendant trust accepted that T had suffered chronic partial hypoxic ischemic insult, but not during labour and not as a result of uterine hyperstimulation, as was alleged. The matter was listed for trial to start on the 21st of April 2020. In preparation for trial, the defendant had a conference with its experts in October 2019, at which the possibility that some of the claimant's disabilities were caused by a genetic condition was raised. The defendant applied to the court for permission to rely on a jointly instructed genetic expert to enable the court to determine whether this was in fact the cause of the claimant's injuries, and that application was heard on the 10th of February 2020, so a little over 2 months before the trial was due to be heard.
And so in light of that very short deadline before the parties are due to face each other in court, what did the court hold?
Well, Mr. Justice Stewart refused the application. The relevant rule was CPR 35.4, which, as everyone will know, provides that no party may call an expert or put in evidence an expert's report without the court's permission. Now, Mr. Justice Stewart agreed with the defendant that that rule itself did not carry with it an implied sanction, and therefore the Rule 3.9 test and the Denton three-stage test was not formally engaged. But what that meant was that the applicable test was not the Denton test, but it was either, firstly, simply applying the overriding objective, or, alternatively, if the application was being made very late, then the test was set out in a case called Heiser and the Islamic Republic of Iran. And the Heiser test involves considering whether there was a good reason for the late application, the significance of the new material that was being proposed, consideration of the prejudice to each party, and the need to do justice to all the parties. And in T and Imperial College, Mr. Justice Stewart applied the Heiser test, having decided that this was indeed a very late application because it would have involved losing the trial date, and applying the Heiser test decided that that was not met and the application was therefore to be dismissed.
And so in light of all of that, listeners might be wondering what it is about this case that made it so interesting that it is in our list of five essential clinical negligence developments. So can you tell us what is interesting about this case?
Well, I think there are three interesting points, or three important points, for practitioners to be aware of, and particularly those that are practicing in clinical negligence. Firstly, from a sort of technical perspective, this case brings some clarity as to whether an application for the addition of expert evidence after the initial making of directions is an application which involves relief from sanction under CPR 3.9. or not. And from the point of view of a party making the application for late inclusion of expert evidence, there may be some forensic advantage in not being required to frame an application in the Denton way, particularly where the trial date is not likely to be affected by the new expert evidence. The second point, though, is a bit of a qualification on the first, because if the application is one that is being made, in quotes, very late, i.e. it's one that jeopardises the trial date, there may be very little difference in substance between the Denton test and the Heiser test that was applied in this case. Both involve consideration of whether there is a good reason for the timing of the application, as well as a general consideration of the need to do justice between the parties and the wider circumstances of the case, which are considerations mandated by the overriding objective. The third point that practitioners should be aware of is some useful practical advice given by Mr. Justice Stewart. What Mr. Justice Stewart says is the following, in quotes, "I should say that if an application which may well cause the vacation of a trial date is made, then it should go to QB judges listing and it should be made clear just how urgent the matter is. And if, after an initial email and or telephone call, there is not some response, then it should be asked to be referred to myself as judge in charge of the list." This was in the context of there being some delay in the application being heard as a result of it being notified to the wrong department within the Queen's Bench Division. And so practitioners should bear in mind that there is a process which will hopefully result in these sorts of applications being heard speedily. And that's set out at paragraph 31 of the judgment in this case.
That's very helpful to know. And I want to thank both of you for coming on the pod and outlining key medical law developments to listeners. I might leave today's episode by mentioning once again the enormous advantages of the now fully searchable QMLR website. Kieran, as its editor-in-chief, is there anything in particular that you'd like listeners to know?
Yeah, I think I'd just like to encourage everyone to take a look at it. As Emma said, all of our previous articles are on the website and you can search by keywords. Each article is also tagged, so you can click on the tag, for example, non-delegable duties, and see every other article that also has that tag. And you can also view articles by author, so you can see everything, for example, that Richard's written. Or you can also view articles by category, so inquests, costs, regulatory, etc. So, and if you have any feedback or comments or things that you think we could do better, then we'd love to hear from you. But please do check it out. It's www.onecoreqmlr.com.
Brilliant. Well, thank you both again. Thanks for coming on. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks, Emma.
LawPod UK was presented by Emma Louise Fenlon and is produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast and recommend us to a friend.